Welcome to Business Frontiers in Malta, the program exploring the dynamic world of enterprise, innovation, and economic transformation. This series shines a light on startups and entrepreneurship, powerful forces reshaping how we live, work, and do business in Malta and beyond. From bold ideas to disruptive technologies, entrepreneurs are challenging the status quo and driving global change. We will explore what fuels their journey, how they scale, and the obstacles they face in today's competitive markets. Whether you are a founder, policymaker, investor, or just curious about the frontier of modern business, this series is for you. I am your host, Professor Anne-Marie Take, from the Department of Policy, Politics and Governance, and we are broadcasting from the university's radio station, Campus 103.7. On today's program, we'll be talking with our special guest, Trevor Asha, Director, Kite Global, diving into the topic, how Kite Global turns regulation into real business value. So stay tuned because you won't want to miss a moment. Trevor is the director and founder of Kite Global, a leading compliance and information security company. With nearly two decades of experience, Trevor leads a team of experts who assist clients through compliance and cybersecurity challenges, offering expertise in different industry standards. Trevor helps organizations improve their security and manage their regulatory requirements effectively. Under his leadership, Kite Global has become a reliable partner for businesses and regulated entities across multiple jurisdictions, seeking to safeguard their operations and meet compliance standards. His vision is to deliver quality, reliability, and genuine support to every client. Welcome, Trevor.
Thank you for having me.
Trevor, can you explain a little bit your background, you know, in this area related to compliance and to cybersecurity?
First of all, I'm an IT graduate, right, from the University of Malta. So I was one of the first class of IT, BSc IT. And of course, at that time, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to be doing. So it's all a sequence of coincidences. But my first real job was really with one of the big four firms. And that's where I was introduced for the first time to IT audit, right? Which has since become, I would say, my core competence and my background and all of my qualifications from my university years till now have all been in the field of information security and IT audit.
Okay, so Kite, let's go back now to the Kite Global story. So Kite Global works with clients in more than 65 countries. That is incredible. What do you think has been the biggest factor driving that kind of global success?
So, first of all, luck plays an important part in it. A lot of people might actually mention luck as maybe one of the third or fourth reasons, but I strongly believe that luck plays an important part. But we have been quite successful in going into areas where there was a demand, right? So our when we first set up the company almost 20 years ago, we wanted to get into gaming, and that was very successful. We were doing IT audits for gaming companies, for the gaming authority, back then when gaming was still in its infancy. Then we got involved in licensing, and we got into understanding what these gaming companies that are all foreigners, right? They're all investing in Malta. We got to understand how highly regulated that industry is, and not just that. And we slowly started realizing that they have a huge demand on compliance, right? So their obligations for compliance to meet regulations and other compliance other standards, to comply to standards, was huge. So we positioned ourselves to be able to offer these services, right? And when you deal with international standards and you are trained to international standards, then you get exposed to international clients. We found ourselves clients from all over the world requiring our services because, of course, it makes no difference whether they get a local or a foreign company. Some clients actually never even knew where Malta was, right? But through the service, which is, I would say, consistent across or irrespective of the country you're coming from, has got us in touch with these clients, and the list keeps growing, actually.
Okay, so you mentioned the compliance and cybersecurity, and this is a world full of players. What makes Kite Global stand out from the rest?
So the services we provide are definitely not unique, right? It's not that we are the only ones delivering this service. But like I said at the beginning, I come from a Big Four company. And despite the fact that they also provide some of the services that we do, but their core competence is financial audit, right? In the same way, or on the other side of the spectrum, I should say, there are the very technical companies that are delivering products and solutions. And their core competence is delivering their products and solutions and not IT audit and information security consultancy. So we have got ourselves into like a niche where we are focused solely on IT audit, compliance related to information security. And so we've kind of positioned ourselves to be a one-stop shop, as we like to call it, for compliance. So whatever our clients require and as far as their cybersecurity requirements, but more importantly, their compliance to standards and regulations, then we do it, right? Whereas other companies potentially might be a side service line for them. For us, it's our core service.
Okay. And when you talk about your clients, are they local? Are they overseas? Are they foreign companies?
They're from literally all over the world, right? Because we deal with Malta, as successful as it has been with certain industries like gaming and fintech, at the back of it is regulation, right? And regulation is, even though we have been at the forefront of regulating certain industries, but in general, the regulation is common across countries, right? Within the EU, obviously, regulations are very, very similar. So it does not make a difference whether we're operating from Malta or anywhere else, because we help clients comply to standards that are international. Right, so our clients would come from literally all over the world.
Let's just go back to basics, because maybe, you know, for the sake of our listeners, what do we really understand by cybersecurity?
That's actually a broad term. It pretty much is the science where one would protect their information assets, right? And assets could be data, they could be clients, contracts, IT systems. So we would help clients make sure to put in those controls that are helping them protect those assets, right? And the best way to do it is obviously to follow or to align yourself to a standard. And this is exactly what we've been saying, the international standards, because other people have already done that, right? So it's a generally accepted best practice to follow certain standards. And when we do our work, we help clients comply to those standards. And when we put on the hat of an IT auditor, we are reviewing and assessing whether they are actually meeting those standards, whether they have those controls in place to protect the data, their systems, and make sure, of course, that they're not vulnerable to attackers. So
when you talk about standards, just to understand, would GDPR be a standard that you are referring to?
GDPR is actually a regulation, right? And of course, any regulation would have a set of requirements that for us is literally, I don't like to use the word checklist. Actually, I hate the word checklist because it implies that it is a quite a rigid approach, but every regulation lays down a number of requirements in the same way that a standard would do, right? But in the case of GDPR, which was a very important regulation across all EU countries, it's actually a regulation and it's obviously transposed into law in Malta as well. And just like any other emerging regulations, maybe people might not be very familiar, but we have a new regulation also at EU level, which is called DORA, which is related to operation resilience, right? And this comes out of the aftermath of COVID-19. So the regulators out there wanted to make sure that businesses are resilient to any sort of incident, and they continue to be able to provide a service that is considered to be critical to the country in general, you know. But regulations are imposed by regulators, and sometimes those regulators are also imposing on their licensees compliance to certain international standards as well,
such as
the ISO standards, which are considered to be, like, obviously a lot of people might be familiar with ISO 9000, which deals with quality, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, of different ISO standards. For us, one of the most important would be ISO 27001, which is related to information security and considered by many as, like, the let's say, the building blocks of any other information security standard, you know.
Okay. I know we mentioned cybersecurity, and maybe I'm going to zoom in a little bit so we can understand from a practical point of view. So let's say we have a company that has all the data related to the employees and, of course, their clients, whatever. And yet this data is hacked. How does cybersecurity come into this?
Well, cybersecurity should come before the event, right? So this is exactly it. So whereas certain standards and regulation impose on companies the ability to detect a compromise, right, and the ability to have a plan to control the damage and recover, so the incident response part. But that's after the effect, right, after the incident happens. A lot of our work and a lot of the intent behind the requirements that we try to make sure companies have in place is actually to protect and not to recover. So we would try to make sure that certain controls are in place to defend against an attacker, to be notified if there are any suspicious activity before suspicious activity turns into an actual attack, and in general to also prevent and protect against those types of incidents that could also become problematic. For example, employee mistakes. So you would have controls in place to also protect against potential mistakes that could have an impact on the overall security of an organization. There are also other techniques, something which we're also very much involved in, which is very technical, and we call it penetration testing, which is a type of test where we put ourselves in a position of an attacker and we try to hack a company's systems, obviously with their permission, and it's called ethical hacking. And we do this in an attempt to find any weaknesses before the real attackers do, right? So if we find the weaknesses or let's say those bugs, we are able to report them to the company so that they fix them before they get compromised by an outside attacker. And that's an extremely valuable exercise to protect against the outside threats.
You're assuming that many CEOs or committees, you know, in a lot of organizations understand this importance. And sadly and unfortunately, we only give this importance when something goes wrong.
Yep.
So rather than prevent, you know, we try and cure. And this is, of course, where you guys would come into the picture. How can an organization be more aware about this importance, you know, of ensuring that they won't be attacked? from a cyber point of view. I do understand, if I can just mention this, is that I can understand why banks would think of this, because here we're talking of, you know, people's monies, etc. But other organizations, it would not come to mind straight away.
That's actually a very good analogy, because we all understand the importance of banks, for example. But there are other companies out there that are providing a service to customers that are probably even more sensitive than a bank, right? Things like telecoms, for example, right? If a telecom company had to be hacked and their service is down, it literally affects the entire country, right? In the same way that if internet goes down, probably the consequence of that is even more of an impact than if a bank is hacked. Because let's face it, when a bank is hacked, really it's information mostly that they're after, because it's hard to make, to steal money. But there are a lot of similarities out there. It's important, first of all, to understand that information security is not a technical problem. It's an issue that should be discussed in the boardroom, right? The board of directors have an obligation towards information security. But it is true. Awareness tends to be rather, let's say, not as high as it should be, because a lot of people understand cybersecurity to be something that the IT manager should be concerned about, until you show them the potential consequence of a breach, right?
Or until it actually happens.
Or even worse than that, and not to scare the people that are listening, but even worse than that, at times companies are hacked and the company itself is not aware that they are hacked, right? So on average, you know, a company can go for 6 months, 8 months without realizing that they've been hacked. And that's because the intention of the hack is not to cause damage, but to steal data, right? So can you imagine 6-8 months of being hacked, of having an external player inside your system stealing data without you knowing? Just thinking about that is probably worse than if they've decided to discontinue your service, right? Because you can always shut everything down and bring it back up again the next day. But if you have an attacker in your systems for such a long time and you not knowing about it, the consequences is extreme, I would say.
Would there be certain areas where hackers really attack industry-specific industries? Because before we mentioned banks, so we understand that banks, you know, they really try to ensure that there is there are safeguards. But are there any other industries that you might be familiar with that you've come across that hackers tend to attack?
Loads of them, right? For different reasons, but. There would be attacks on the healthcare data, because they're after information about individuals. There are attacks on financial services, as you mentioned, because there potentially is a financial gain. There is attacks for reasons that is competition. Plenty of motivations why someone would want to an attack. And then there are those that I would say seem, for example, an attack on a company, not because they want to attack that company, but because they want to launch an attack on someone else, but not from their own systems, but from someone else's system, right? So I attack your system just to be able to launch another attack on a third company. So the intent behind the attacks can vary a lot, not necessarily financially motivated, but they're always something which is seriously illegal, right?
It's very serious, this situation. So it could be that my data has been collected by a company, an organization, and somebody has hacked that data and sold it to someone else.
Within minutes. So data would be stolen, sold. And for example, we do a lot of work with credit card data security, right? We're qualified security assessors. So we certify companies that deal with credit card data. And when credit card data is lost, and it happens to a lot of us, right? I every time I go to certain countries, I always come back with having to replace my card because I find some suspicious activity on my statement. And what would have happened is my credit card data would have been leaked by someone who was intending to steal card data. They get sold to third parties. Immediately, that data gets copied into a plastic card and it's used to make transactions in a completely other jurisdiction. And
with your money.
With money, yes. Until, of course, you report it, that card number gets blocked. And then there's a whole process of how the banks and the credit card companies have to attempt to recover the money. But the idea, like I said before, is to prevent that from happening. And that is why every company that is processing or handling card data has to follow a certain set of procedures that have to have certain controls in place so that card data does not get stolen. Not to mention that even the bank itself, when you report your card stolen, it costs a lot of money to replace that card. And of course, to return the money back to the cardholder and potentially, hundreds or thousands of other affected customers.
So in a nutshell, what you're saying, Trevor, is that my data is stolen. But not only is my data stolen, my money is stolen as well from my card.
Potentially, yes. Right? Potentially, yes. Because when a card number is stolen, until the attacker is trying to use that data, you don't know, right? That is why I always have to report my card stolen every time I come back from a country where my details have been stolen, because it usually takes a few days or possibly even longer for the attacker to want to make use of that data. And as soon as they try to make a purchase, potentially they manage to do that, I see that on my statement, right? And at that point, I report it. But there are other situations where it might take longer for me to realize that I have a lot of transactions. But the potential for compromise there is significant, and the banks, of course, take the big hit there.
If I can make a reference, in the last budget, it has been announced that we would be given an e-wallet on our phones. This would contain all our data. Would cybersecurity somewhere feature in this?
It would definitely feature. I am not very aware of what is currently being proposed at the technical level, but for sure, there would be controls in the way that only you can access that wallet. And those would be, and we've already seen it, things like two-factor authentication, for example, whereby it's become very common. You don't just access your bank these days by just a username and a password, but you need another factor, either a PIN code or biometrics or an SMS that gets sent to you. And that is a way of making sure that you are who you say you are. And that protects the access to that account. And in this particular case, the wallet, the most important thing is not the security of the transactions themselves, although that's also very important, but that only you, the individual that owns that wallet, have access to that wallet.
Okay, very good. Let's move on a little bit now to the world of compliance. Okay, so we talked about cybersecurity and now we're going on to the compliance function. So regulations and standards, which you made reference to, seem to change faster than ever. Right. How does Kite Global stay ahead of those shifts?
Yes, we have positioned ourselves in a way that our clients come to us whenever they have a requirement for compliance, right? Sometimes it is they want to enter a new market, so the regulator in that particular country wants them to comply to a particular standard or wants them to get a license in that country, right? Which is also the equivalent of complying to a set of requirements. So we have to get ourselves trained, you know, prepared. To be honest with you, the requirements are different, but the process is the same. So that would see us perform the necessary research and get ourselves informed and also trained in that particular subject. Sometimes we have to get ourselves qualified and certified to be able to provide that service to clients. So in the same way that clients have to comply, we have to be ahead of that to be able to offer that service.
So when you say you need to keep up to date with these changes, regulations and standards, and you made reference to training, what does it really mean in practice?
Training is extremely important. So first of all, some of the certifications we hold require us to go to training every year, right? So our company spends hundreds of thousands in training every year. And I must say, it's not because we believe in training, but we're also mandated to undergo the training, right? So we are forced to go for training on a yearly basis to be able to retain our credentials. But for new services, right, or new standards, if we expect clients to come to us so that we help them comply, then we have to get our people trained, literally send them to training. And when a certification is also possible, we ask them to sit in for those exams to get themselves certified as well.
Okay. We will continue talking about this, but now we will take a short musical break. Please stay tuned to Campus 103.7 to continue listening to the discussion on how Kite Global turns regulation into real business value. Before we go, the following song.
We Pray from Coldplay.
Trevor, why did you choose it?
Well, Coldplay is a favorite of both myself and my wife. Recently, we've had the opportunity to go watch them in London as well. It was one of the most amazing shows. It was actually a gift for my wife for her graduation. So it was fantastic to see her have fun. And I thought it was fit.
Shelter and some records to play, and so we pray. We'll be singing by right day till nobody's in need of anything.
Welcome back to Business Frontiers in Malta with me, Anne-Marie Take. Now let us get into the second part of the discussion. With me, I have Trevor Asha, CEO of Kite Global. Trevor, why is it called Kite Global? Just as a name.
Well, it's a brand name, really, but primarily because, as I was mentioning previously, the work that we do has pretty much taken us on the international level, right? So even though we are very much proud to be a Malta company, we operate on the international market primarily. So we thought it would make sense to change our brand to the Kite Global brand.
So just to understand, it's Kite, K-Y-T-E, and not K-I-T-E.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
No particular reason for that.
All right. Also, before the break, we had talked about the regulations and standards, but now we're going into compliance. And many businesses see compliance as just a box to tick. How do you help your clients view it instead as a strategic advantage?
It's a very important question, but very difficult to approach in the sense that a company, with all their good intentions, they would want to comply and to have all the controls in place, but at the same time, they have a business to run. And it does happen that companies find their compliance obligations as stopping them from being able to continue doing their business. So the trick there is to find the balance between getting the value from these standards that you need to comply with and without putting in too many, restrictions on you doing your business. Of course, we cannot convince a client to appreciate, the value of every single regulation and standard they have to comply with. What we can do, however, is from our point of view, we try to instill in our people the sense of value. Right. So everything that we do has at the back of it the intention of adding value. And so it's not just telling the client you have to have this in place or you have to have that document, but showing the client why we are asking for that control. This is what stops that particular attack from happening, or having this in place protects you from potential legal exposure. So that is, we play a small part in that, at least to educate the client into the value that these standards and regulations bring to their business. But at the same time, we appreciate that some of these entities, especially the highly regulated ones, are what I sometimes like to refer to as they're in a constant state of audit, because when one audit ends, they have another audit from another completely different entity on another subject, right? So you can also understand the frustration on that side.
Yes, when you talk about a very highly regulated industry, so for example, a pharmaceutical industry?
As well, although not necessarily on the subject of information security, because they have a lot of other standards and regulations to comply with. But within fintech, for example, banks or electronic money institutions, gaming companies as well, because sometimes we look at gaming as if it's this completely unregulated company that is just gambling, right? But at the back of it, they're extremely regulated. They have to comply with a bunch of different standards. And every time they get a license in another country, because unfortunately that's the way it is, but that's a long story. Every time they go to a country and they want to offer their services in another country, they're asked to get a license in that country. And that opens up another set of obligations, controls. Say, for example, one jurisdiction in particular requires three or four different ISO standards to be complied with. This in addition to the gaming regulations themselves, right? And that's just for one jurisdiction. And in the same way, of course, fintech companies have also those obligations.
So if I was a startup and I was in fintech and I wanted to set up in Spain, I would have to ensure that I have certain standards and abide by their laws.
Correct.
And if I then decide that I would like to go to another European country, I would also have to repeat all this again.
Not exactly. Within gaming, just to be clear, that is exactly the case, right? As much as I, you know, oppose that idea and am completely against it. But within the fintech, that does not happen. The reason being is that within the EU, if you get a license within the EU and you comply with all the rules, regulations of that country, then you can apply for what is referred to as passporting. So you would be able to offer your services to other EU member states without requiring any additional licensing, right? But then again, of course, if you then have a physical presence in a in another country, then potential other obligations come into play. But from a fintech point of view, the obligations are still a long list. We help clients, let's say, navigate that journey to get the license, which is a big achievement, you know, and a milestone, but also to then continue to remain compliant.
Okay. We can now move on a little bit, although, you know, we talked about cybersecurity and compliance challenges. I have a last question related to this, is that from your perspective, what are the biggest cybersecurity and compliance challenges companies will face in the next few years?
We are already getting a taste of what's about to happen, even if you look at the trends. First of all, because you mentioned before the type of attacks, what sort of data they're trying to steal. Another very interesting thing to note is how are they doing it? And they continue to target the individual, the human being, right? Which is probably the weakest link in the whole security chain, let's say. Because humans can be manipulated, they can be tricked. And social engineering continues to be one of the biggest forms of attack, or the start of a bigger attack, right? Because usually this is what the attacker wants to do. They want to get access to the system through some sort of social engineering, forcing you to click on a link or forcing you to go to a particular website. And from then, once they get access to that system, that's where then they start the attack. So malware and social engineering continue to be very prevalent. And of course, now with AI, things just get a bit more complicated. We have deep fakes now, which is where they're getting really sophisticated. You just do not know whether you're really seeing a real image or a real video, or whether it's completely computer generated. And that would be a challenge for companies to make sure that they don't get tricked. And yeah, as good as AI is, and the technologies that are emerging are incredible, but at the same time, they also are used in a bad way, and they become challenges to companies securing their system, and to us, evaluating whether they are at risk of such threats.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit about this, but for the sake of our listeners, what are deep fakes?
Deep fakes are a phenomenon, I would say, of where even videos, and we've seen them sometimes on the internet as jokes, where, for example, they put an image of a famous person and the video and the script is something that it's not real, it's not what that person is saying, but it is actually generated, right? And they're becoming very, very realistic. So when you look at that potential of making someone potentially look like he's saying something when in fact it's not, that can be compromised to or used to assume someone's identity, for example, right? So potentially banks, let's say, when they want to verify your identity, they could be tricked into thinking they're talking to you, but in actual fact, it's completely generated by an attacker, right? And that, again, even though there are tools and systems nowadays to detect those sort of attacks, but they are happening, you know, and that's an alarming rate as well.
Okay. So this leads me now on to innovation and technology, and you made reference to AI. So how is Kite Global using AI, automation, or analytics to make compliance smarter and more efficient?
We're working on that. We have big plans for next year. We would like to integrate. We are already using AI in a number of ways, but probably in the same way that a number of other companies are in content creation and social media. But the next step for us, at least, is to help us make our work more efficient. Because let's face it, even when we do an IT audit, we're bound and constrained by time, constrained by the number of tests that we can do, constrained by the sample size that we take to be able to perform our testing. So through the use of AI, we should and would like to make our work quicker and as a result be able to do more deep testing and, of course, in that case, add value to the client.
So with technology evolving so fast, would you think that AI will replace some of these compliance roles, or will it, do you think, create new opportunities instead?
It will definitely reshape. I would not think that it is going to replace any roles, but it is going to force us to change the way we do things. And there will come a time when, of course, everyone is using AI to do their job. And that is where the trick is, right? The trick is to get yourself ready, prepared and trained to be able to use AI in your work and not, of course, to replace the people that are currently doing the work. Especially in our line of business, the human element continues to be extremely important because it's true that we're assessing systems, but we're also dealing with human beings on the other side. We are not eliminating the human touch at all.
Are there any new projects, maybe, or innovations at Kite Global that you are excited about right now?
We have a lot going on, yes. A lot of the things that are still in their infancy. But like I said, the idea of using technology is to streamline the work that we do and to do it in a way that maybe gives better results, if that makes sense, because some of the work we currently are doing, so I mentioned before penetration testing, for example. In penetration testing, when we're actually trying to attack a system, we are given 5-10 days of work, for example, and of course we get paid for 5 or 10 days of work, depending on the scope. So we try to find as many vulnerabilities as we possibly can in that time frame and in that restriction. But if we had to spend 20 days on that test just to be able to find something, we'll go out of business, right? So we have to automate in a way, and we're leveraging AI to facilitate that and to, like I said before, to add better value to that process.
How many people work for Kite Global in Malta?
Good question. That changes all the time because we have almost a 50-50 split between Maltese people and foreigners, right? We have foreign employees that are employed and sometimes they choose to go back to their country but still continue to work for us. So in Malta, I would say we are about 25 and we have a few people working for us remotely from their own country, which are unfortunately contractors to us in that way, but nonetheless we treat them like employees, of course.
Do you have men and women, different genders?
It's also probably a 50-50 split as well. Not necessarily intentionally, but we like the mix that we have.
Okay. And when you said that you have a number of employees who actually work from their country, what countries are we talking about?
Africa, Europe, Asia, literally all over the world.
So different continents.
As well. Which does not really make a difference, honestly, because if you're on a video conference, whether you are in Australia or in the US or in Malta, except for the time difference, of course, it makes absolutely no difference, even for the work with the clients, because with most of our clients have systems in the cloud, right? So whether the client is in Malta or anywhere else, the client is always going to share his screen and show us a connection to the cloud, right? So that's not even in his own office. So the fact that our auditor is not in the same office as the client, there was a time when we used to visit every client physically and travel all over the world. That has changed, because nowadays through video conferencing, we're pretty much able to do probably more than we used to do when we visit the client.
I'm sure it was a cost saving as well.
Absolutely. And the time saving, because the time, the commuting, the traveling and the scheduling of work would not allow us to have to do 2-3 clients at the same time. Whereas nowadays with a video call, as soon as you cut from that person, you can immediately jump on a call with someone else in a completely different continent. Okay. And that was incredible.
So to understand this, if somebody from Africa or somebody from Asia, countries within these continents, are working for your company, which regulations or laws would apply to that individual?
As far as us, the company, is concerned, everyone needs to follow the policies and procedures that the Malta entity dictates, right? For the simple reason that we contract with the client using the Malta entity, so we're bound with policies and procedures and terms of reference that we put in the contract with the client. So the client expects that all our people are following those same policies, and those are all centralized and managed by the Malta entity.
Okay, but let me give you an example of why I asked this question. So let's say an individual working in a different time zone for your company on behalf of a client, and yet the individual works on reduced hours. How does that apply if we're talking about maybe an individual working in China?
There are different solutions, but we try not to complicate matters. For us, employees are those employees that are in Malta and resident, and for foreigners and third country nationals with a work permit. Those employees that choose to go back to their country or to even never come here, they won't be on the payroll, right? So they would not be bound themselves with, let's say, with a typical employment agreement. But in terms of delivering the work, they have to follow the policies and procedure of the Malta company. But in terms of their employment position, it would be a contractor type of relationship.
All right. Okay, I understand you. Okay, so let's now move on to leadership and culture.
Okay.
So you lead a team of experts across many fields, as you were explaining to us. So how do you keep that culture of learning and collaboration alive?
I must say, first of all, that the aspect of management is much harder than people assume, right? Managing people is probably the hardest thing that I have to do on a daily basis. So managing people to be able to manage different characters, different cultures, the different abilities, their needs, because everyone has obviously their own needs and expectations. I think the idea is to assume a leadership role, right? And the idea is making sure that first priority, of course, is to grow the company and to protect the interests of the company. But a very close second is to make sure and guarantee the development of the employees themselves. Because ultimately, we're in the service industry, and without the employees, we pretty much can't do anything without them, right? So it is not easy, like I said, because people are very different. But we try to look at every individual with their potential and have a plan for their growth and how they would fit in the current situation of the company and where we want them to fit in the future as well. And that took some time to get in place, but it's giving its fruit as well.
Did you feel you yourself had to maybe discover a little bit more about people's culture in different countries, which are different to Malta?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think they appreciate the fact that we are sensitive to that, because we have individuals, for example, that have left family behind and they are living in Malta, right? So if they make a request, for example, that they want to go visit their family every once in a while and spend some time with them, you know, it would not make sense for us to reject that request. But potentially not everyone would, accept such a request, right? But for us, we feel it's very important, because in the same way that the, you know, the, these employees are sacrificing, let's say, a lot for the company, I think it makes sense for us to also be sensitive to their needs. We don't have huge cultural conflicts, but at the same time, we prevent any of those conflicts, right? So it's very important.
Okay. What qualities do you look for when hiring young professionals at Kite Global?
Very good question, because I'm not really very good at that, honestly speaking, because the intention behind the questions during an interview, at least from my point of view, is to evaluate the character of the individual. The academic qualifications are very secondary, if not third or fourth in the list of what is important. Experience is probably much more important than the qualifications themselves, at least in our line of work. But because I fail in the evaluation process, then I get help, right? So I have consultants that help me with that process, so that I would look at the character of the individual, whether I think I can work with this person, whether I think that person can work with us. And the consultants would give me their feedback on whether this person can do the job, whether this person is committed to the role, whether they think that this person would last. Those are, you know, one of the things that I've learned, and probably a little bit too late in my career, is to understand your limitations, right? And that's exactly what I'm doing in those areas where I feel I need help, I get help.
Okay. So talking about these qualities, and I know there are different criteria, as you mentioned, you know, the importance of the character and all the cultural fit within your company. If I can mention, for example, qualifications, we're at the university. So this is one of the areas that students, you know, have on their mind. Would you look for somebody who is qualified or has a degree at university? Or would you say that the certifications, like you made reference to from an IT point of view, are more important or more relevant to your line of work?
I wouldn't say one is more important than the other, because everyone has different paths, right? When I was at university myself, I had no idea what I wanted to do after I graduated. So you would assume that some people would have changed their career paths, right? Halfway. So the fact that someone might not have a related degree, right, or a degree that in some way is related to IT, is not necessarily a bad thing. For me, a university degree helps to gauge a person in terms of having reached a certain academic level, right? But contrary to what many students believe, after you leave university, after you graduate, then that is where the training actually starts. And that's where the learning actually starts. And that sometimes comes across in interviews, right? Where you see young graduates that think that they've reached a level, when in actual fact, they are just starting on the first step of the ladder, let's say. But certifications are extremely important, because they are very much specific to the work that you want the individual to perform. So we have, within the company, we don't have everyone having the same certifications, because not everyone does the same work. So for example, you mentioned GDPR before, which is a service which we provide. The people that do the work in GDPR obviously get certified in GDPR. Whereas most of the other employees that are IT auditors would look for certifications like CISA, CISM, CISSP. These are all very specific and focused certifications, and it gives a certain measure of whether that person actually has achieved a certain competence in that subject. And for those individuals that don't have those certifications, we make sure to put it in the plan for the first 6 months of employment with us.
So just to understand, Trevor, so Kite Global will pay for these students to be trained and obtain a certification in an area that they are working in?
Absolutely. We can't do without that, right? Our clients expect us to be experts in the field that we're providing the service, and we can't do that unless our people are qualified and trained. And yeah, where a certification exists, certified as well.
You know, we're at the University of Malta. Which door would you knock on in terms of a faculty where you may be interested in increasing your talent pipeline?
I mean, I suppose I'm a bit biased, right? Because I graduated in IT back in 1999. So I still consider that to be a very decent degree. And I'm also pleased to note that in that course, but also in others, information security is also being taught. So that is very important because at least students are getting a glimpse of, you know, the industry out there, you know, not just information security from the point of view of textbooks, but also what companies are facing out there, what tools they're using to protect themselves. So not just from a theory point of view, but also from a practical, which is pretty much what we're discussing here today.
Yes. So the faculty of ICT would probably be the door you would knock on. And would you say FEMA, the Faculty of Economics, Management and Accountancy, would be a consideration?
There is a lot of overlap, right? We also see as well that some of the certifications that to us are desirable are the certifications that, for example, some accountants are also getting into. Not necessarily because the accountants want to become IT auditors, but because they realize that there is a lot of value in them understanding the IT audit side of things for them conducting the work that they do, right? So there's a lot of overlap, engineering as well. Some people, to be honest with you, originally when I first joined the university, I always thought that I was going to go for engineering. And some of my colleagues actually are engineers. So I wouldn't say that it defines the path that you'll take, you know, the course that you choose, but it will definitely open up doors, yes.
Okay. Now I'm leading to my last question, a bit of advice maybe for students and for those who are interested in cybersecurity or compliance or consulting. What skills or maybe mindset do you think matter most today?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. Simply because the advice that you're asking me to give is for the youngsters of today and not for the youngsters of 10 years ago, right? Which is a very different thing. I would maybe answer you in a different way. The young people of today have access to information like never before, right? They have all the information at the fingertips, on the phone, the use of AI, ChatGPT, and other similar tools. Which is all great, and they have to continue evolving that skill as well. But we need to make sure that that does not come at a cost of self-development, right? So knowledge should continue to be the focus of studies and of a person's own development. And sometimes I'm noticing that the fact that a person knows where to access information does not mean that that person has learned that information. I believe that we have to focus on the development aspect of an individual, and hard work, this definitely never goes out of fashion.
Okay, very good, Trevor. Well, that is all the time we have for today's programme. I wish to thank our guest, Mr. Trevor Asha, CEO of Kite Global, for taking time out to accept our invitation. I would also like to thank Mark Ajus for the technical assistance of this programme. Thank you so much for tuning in to Business Frontiers in Malta. I am Anne-Marie Teck from the University of Malta, and it's been a pleasure spending this time with you.